We will see you next week. Be good, stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the third night of the Democratic National Convention featured several party stars and heavy hitters, most notably former President Barack Obama, who issued his most scathing and brutally honest critique of Donald Trump so far.
I never expected that my successor would embrace my vision or continue my policies. I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously, that he might come to feel the weight of the office and discover some reverence for the democracy that had been placed in his care. But he never did. For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work, no interest in finding common ground, no interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends, no interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves. Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe. This administration has shown it will tear our democracy down if that's what it takes for them to win. So we have to get busy building it up by pouring all our efforts into these 76 days and by voting like never before for Joe and Kamala and candidates up and down the ticket, so that we leave no doubt about what this country that we love stands for.
That's Barack Obama speaking at the DNC on Wednesday evening, the third night of the Democratic National Convention. President Trump, clearly rankled by Obama's criticism, anger tweeted several times in capital letters during the speech. Obama's Secretary of State and the winner of the popular vote in the 2016 presidential race, Hillary Clinton, also addressed the virtual gathering, warning Americans of the importance of voting.
This can't be another woulda, coulda, shoulda election. If you vote by mail, request your ballot now and send it back right away. If you vote in person, do it early. Become a poll worker. Most of all, no matter what, vote. As Michelle Obama and Bernie Sanders warned us, if Trump is reelected, things will get even worse. That's why we need unity now more than ever.
That's former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking at the DNC. California Senator Kamala Harris made history in becoming the first Black and first Asian person of any major party to accept the vice presidential nomination, and the second woman after Geraldine Ferraro to accept the vice presidential nomination for the Democratic Party. Here is part of her speech.
I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America. I do so committed to the values she taught me, to the word that teaches me to walk by faith and not by sight, and to a vision passed on through generations of Americans, one that Joe Biden shares, a vision of our nation as a beloved community where all are welcome. No matter what we look like, no matter where we come from, or who we love. A country where we may not agree on every detail, but we are united by the fundamental belief that every human being is of infinite worth, deserving of compassion, dignity, and respect.
That's Kamala Harris accepting the Democratic Party's vice presidential nomination on Wednesday night. On Thursday, the fourth and final night of the convention, Joe Biden will accept the presidential nomination. Hoping to upstage Biden, Trump has announced a plan to speak at an event in Pennsylvania, outlining his rival's failings. Trump's former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon has been arrested on charges of fraud, along with three other men. New York federal prosecutors charged the group with misusing millions of dollars raised from a private crowdfunding campaign to finance the president's pet project of a border wall with Mexico. Although all four claimed their group, We Build the Wall, would be run by volunteers, Bannon and his colleagues spent significant portions of the money on their own personal use, using shell companies and fake invoices to try to hide the paper trail. According to the Washington Post, quote, Bannon was taken into custody off of the coast of Westbrook, Connecticut, while aboard a 150-foot yacht owned by his friend, Chinese billionaire Guo Wengui, who is wanted by authorities in Beijing on charges of fraud, blackmail, and bribery. Trump has distanced himself from Bannon and the project, but just 1 year ago, the president's own son, Donald Jr., appeared as a special guest at a speaking event hosted by We Build the Wall, and he lauded their efforts, saying, "What you guys are doing is amazing." The group also offered autographed copies of Trump Jr.'s books in exchange for donations. A federal judge has just ruled that Trump must turn over 8 years' worth of personal and business tax returns to the New York District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. in a case involving the investigation of potential criminal activity by the Trump Organization. The president's lawyers are likely to appeal the ruling all the way to the Supreme Court, and it would be the second time the case would go before the nation's highest court. Trump on Wednesday expressed support for the shadowy conspiracy group QAnon, saying,
"Well, I don't know much about the movement other than I understand they like me very much, which I appreciate, but I don't know much about the movement. I have heard that it is gaining in popularity, and I've heard these are people that love our country."
That's Trump giving his blessing to a movement of right-wing conspiracy theorists who believe, among other things, that Trump is saving America from a Democratic Party that is a satanic cult of pedophiles and cannibals. Recently, one QAnon member won a GOP primary in Georgia, and Trump dubbed her a, quote, rising star. In economic news, unemployment claims are once more up, breaking through the 1 million mark. The Labor Department's latest figures from jobless benefits filed last week shows an increase after a minor decrease from the week before. The numbers underscore the desperate and urgent need for economic relief for Americans in a bill that has stalled in Congress after Senate Republicans balked at spending money on ordinary people. Meanwhile, a new study has found that at the intersection of the pandemic and related economic collapse, many working mothers have been forced to give up their jobs and turn to childcare in the home. In California, a utilities worker and a helicopter pilot were killed fighting the raging fires in the Bay Area that have blanketed the region in smoke and burned more acres of land so far than in all of 2019. The fires were ignited by about 11,000 lightning strikes in hot, dry, and windy conditions during a record-breaking heat wave. Californians are having to choose between running their air conditioning as they keep their windows closed in 90-degree weather to keep out the smoke, or risking power outages in rolling blackouts, and that's if they have air conditioning at all. And finally, the state of Michigan has reached a $600 million settlement with defendants in a 5-year-long case over the Flint water crisis. The money will go into a fund that will directly benefit victims of the water crisis, in particular, young people who are disproportionately impacted. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Sean Hannity, the popular Fox News host, said on his program, in the wake of the Senate report on Russia's interference in our election, that just like he's been saying for years, the report proves there was no collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign in 2016. Except that exactly the opposite is true. After 3 years, Republican and Democratic senators released a nearly 1,000-page report that not only confirms the findings of the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, but goes much further in confirming high levels of contact between Trump's campaign and Russian operatives. In fact, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office on Thursday attempted to reinstate the indictment of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort based on the damning findings of the report. My guest is Matt Gertz, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. His latest article is called Fox News Really Doesn't Care About Voluminous Evidence of Trump-Russia Malfeasance. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So I just briefly mentioned what Sean Hannity said, but can you expand on how Fox News hosts like him have been treating this Senate report, if they are at all covering it?
Yeah, it disappeared awfully quickly off of Fox's airwaves. You know, they have spent years generating this alternate narrative in which any claims that the Trump campaign engaged in any sort of malfeasance with Russia during the 2016 election is all a bunch of lies. It's a hoax. It's a conspiracy theory. They've been saying this for years. And then this report dropped on Tuesday from a committee that is led by Republicans. And it said that there is a wide range of Russian efforts to try to help Trump win the 2016 election, and that Trump's campaign was willing to accept aid from that country's government. It's filled with incredibly damning details about Paul Manafort, about George Papadopoulos, about the Russian effort to suborn our democracy that happened during 2016. And Fox just disappeared it incredibly quickly. They don't want to talk about it. They had a few segments on Tuesday, but by 6 a.m. on Wednesday morning, they were done. And it just stopped talking about it altogether. It's really a sign of how willing the network is to be a propaganda outlet for this administration and what they're willing to sweep under the rug to keep Trump in power.
We apparently also found through the Senate report that Trump himself was very much aware of the WikiLeaks email hack and was very much willing, which of course was obtained from Russian operatives, and was very much willing to use that or interested in using it as a way for his campaign to get ahead. So, I mean, we're talking about implication at the highest levels of the Trump campaign. That's Trump himself.
Yeah, I mean, if you'll recall, there were several different tranches of documents that were stolen by the Russian military intelligence. These were documents from the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Congressional Committee, and from John Podesta, who is Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. The DNC documents were released very early, right around the time of the Democratic convention in July. But the Podesta emails were not released until October. And so after the DNC documents were released in July, Trump became very, very curious about what else WikiLeaks could have. The report explains that the documents were provided to WikiLeaks by Russian military intelligence. And so Trump wanted to know what else that they could have, what else could be coming out. And so he tasked someone to look into it, to find out what was going on. It was Roger Stone, the longtime dirty trickster who has been Trump's political consigliere for decades.
And who Roger Trump Stone, just pardoned.
Who Trump just
commuted his sentence. Right, yes. Right. Yes, thank you.
Who had engaged in, according to the special counsel, basically had been lying to Congress in order to protect the president, to cover up what he had done. So what you have here is a Trump political operative being asked to find out about illegal activity involved in the campaign, not to try to stop it, but to try to benefit from it as much as possible. And everyone involved seems to think that he succeeded. The Trump campaign thinks that he got solid, useful information about further details. We don't know exactly what Stone had learned or how, because he used a variety of different methods to conceal his communications. But it's quite clear that the Trump campaign was trying to benefit from Russian interference in the election.
Another connection that the Senate report laid out was the links between Paul Manafort, who was campaign chair of the Trump campaign, his associate and colleague Konstantin Kilimnik, and Kilimnik's links to the Russian military intelligence agency, the GRU, which was the agency that we know obtained the emails from the Clinton campaign server. So, if you know, it's there's been simplified that Trump campaign colluded with Russia, that Putin helped Trump win. But if this Senate report is true, and there's no reason to believe that Senate Republicans would put something out that would be damning to Trump, then you basically have Trump linked to Manafort, linked to Kilimnik, who is directly linked apparently to the GRU, which is the Russian military agency, intelligence agency.
Yes, the crucial detail here that the report lays out is that Kilimnik didn't just have some sort of nebulous ties to Russian intelligence, but it actually describes him as a Russian intelligence officer, someone who was working for the Russian government. And this is someone who has been a close business associate of Paul Manafort for many, many years. And the report says that he likely served as a channel to Manafort for the Russian intelligence services. And it also found that there was some information that is not released in the report that's been redacted, suggesting that Kilimnik may have been connected to the hack and leak operation itself. So this is a very direct line between the top ranks of the Trump campaign to his campaign chair himself to the Russian intelligence effort to help Trump win the election. This is incredibly damning stuff. The sort of thing that if you had told people what was happening a few years ago, they would look at you and be shocked. But I think what we've seen at this point is that the Republicans have cleaved so closely to Trump, and they're so unwilling to step back in any way that it's to some extent deadening the story.
We also apparently see implications against Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr., Trump's son-in-law and son, respectively, who, of course, were working very closely with the Trump campaign, continue to work closely with Trump in the White House and his re-election campaign. And none of this should surprise us, right, Matt? I mean, when we look at the topic on which the House impeached Trump, which was Trump trying to extract a political favor from Ukraine's president to get an advantage for the 2020 election, and Trump's own public admission that he would be willing to accept help from countries depending upon what the help was, that he, you know, has been quite open in soliciting help, and his operatives have been open in soliciting help from other nations. This shouldn't surprise us. This seems now, three, 4 years later, very consistent with Trump's MO.
Well, and this is what Chairman Adam Schiff of the House Intelligence Committee warned during the impeachment trial itself in the Senate. He said, look, Trump is someone who has done this before. We saw between him and, accepting help from Russia to win the 2016 election. He's someone who has just done it again with regards to trying to get aid out of Ukraine to help with the 2020 election. And that if he's not removed from office, he will absolutely try to do it again. I think it's quite clear that the president has no real limitations on the types of help he's willing to accept from foreign governments, and that the conservative media is going to do everything it can to try to sweep those damning details under the rug to help him across the finish line.
Whenever the topic of Russia's interference in the 2016 election, the Trump campaign's willingness to accept that help, whenever that is raised among conservatives, lawmakers, or media figures, they jump on the issue of the Steele dossier. We hear them talk about the Steele dossier, named after Christopher Steele. And I understand that there is a small section in the Senate report on the Steele dossier. Given the Republican senators and House of Representatives' obsession with the Steele dossier, what ended up in the Senate report on this issue? And did Fox News fixate on that aspect of it at all?
Yeah, that was the part of the report that Fox wanted to spend the most time on.
Of
that,
course. I believe it was just 80 pages out of 953.
Absolutely. But, they've spent a very long time building up this complex counter-narrative that the real problem during the 2016 election was that was the investigation into Russian interference itself, that the FBI and DOJ were engaged in a sort of political attack on the Trump campaign. Now, this is belied by the fact that information about that FBI investigation into Russian interference and whether it was deliberately designed to help Trump didn't leak during that time, during that campaign. And in fact, you saw articles from the New York Times and elsewhere saying that there was no connection seen by the FBI between Trump and Russia. But Fox has spent a lot of time ginning up this conspiracy theory, and I think the Steele dossier does help them do it. It appears to be a set of memos that did not turn out to be particularly credible, that were used at times in different ways by that federal investigation, but were not the root cause of that investigation, and certainly don't in any way debunk all of the obvious collusion that was going on involving Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and all the rest. But it is something that they are going to want to fixate on, and they're going to keep that in the dialogue around Trump and Russia as much as they can.
Is it clear to you that the Republican and Democratic senators involved in writing this report agree on the basic facts that Russia tried to very hard, the government of Russia, tried very hard to influence the Trump campaign, tried to help them, and are at it again in 2020?
Yes, they seem quite clear on that point. The main area of disagreement that you see is that the congressional Republicans, the Senate Republicans, having assembled all of this information about ties between Trump and Russia, end up concluding that they found no evidence that Trump and his campaign colluded with the Russian government in their efforts to meddle in the election. Meanwhile, the Democrats look at the same set of facts. They look at Manafort and Kilimnik, and they say, this is what collusion looks like. If you expect more than what you're already seeing here, you're just not likely to find it. And in fact, you're not looking for the full story.
The fact that the Senate report was able to clarify more than the Mueller report did, you know, you just sort of have to wonder about the timing. I remember in the lead up to the release of the special counsel's probe, there was a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement, a lot of fear from the Trump people. And then, you know, it was a bit of an anticlimax. Here we have a report whose timing could have been so much better, whose results are so much more damning. And that came out at a time when, you know, people are wearied, they're fatigued. The impeachment process on a different matter is here and gone. And they're gearing up for the election. And it seems as though all matters, all of these issues point to a general rug sweeping effort that this report is going to end up in.
Well, they did spend quite a lot of time generating the report. So I don't want to be too uncharitable about the sort of timeline. However, it is kind of interesting that they decided to drop it in the middle of the Democratic convention rather than before the convention or the following week during the Republican convention, when it would have been perhaps more damaging to Trump. I think it's difficult to get away from that possibility.
So there's also news that broke this week that Steve Bannon was arrested, chief White House strategist, arrested along with three others on charges of defrauding donors to a massive crowdfunding campaign to fund Trump's wall, border wall. This was a private effort that Trump is now distancing himself from, but his own son, Donald Jr., spoke at an event last year of this organization that raised this money, and Bannon and his colleagues basically lined their pockets with this money. To me, and I'm wondering if you feel the same way, all of this suggests, and of course Bannon was involved in helping to elect Trump as well, all of this suggests that this is basically a band of criminals, if not crime-adjacent people, who have taken over the White House. And even though Bannon is, you know, had left the White House, he maintains his support for Trump, and is linked to Trump. I mean, time after time, person after person is implicated in these very dirty deeds.
Yeah, he's running out of close associates, I would say. You know, Steve Bannon is someone who, was the campaign manager or chair, I should say, of Trump's campaign in 2016, subsequently was in the White House as his chief strategist, and was picked up by federal law enforcement on the boat of his Chinese exile patrons, has been arrested and is now going to be on trial with the possibility of spending a very long time in jail. It looks like that there was basically a grift involved here.
It would be really interesting to see how Fox covers this, if at all.
It will be, yes, because they spent a lot of time puffing up this particular organization that Bannon and Colfage led. They spent a lot of airtime telling their audience all about it and perhaps leading many of them to donate to this effort that ended up lining Bannon's pockets to the tune of over $1 million, according to the indictment.
Well, Matt, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people read your writings for Media Matters?
You can read it all at mediamatters.org.
And we'll link to your latest piece from our website. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you.
My guest has been Matt Gaertz, Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America. His latest article is called Fox News Really Doesn't Care About Voluminous Evidence of Trump-Russia Malfeasance. We've been discussing, among other things, the Senate report on Russian interference in the 2016 election, Volume 5 of which was just released a few days ago. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. One of the most jarring trends during the coronavirus pandemic is that Wall Street is booming while Americans are desperately struggling. The wealth of billionaires like Jeff Bezos has dramatically multiplied, even as tens of millions of Americans have lost jobs. Companies like Amazon have an outsized power in our society and economy. And writing about the massive monopolies that have emerged today is the well-known progressive figure Zephyr Teachout. She's an attorney, political activist, and antitrust and corruption expert. In 2018, she ran for New York Attorney General and was endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders. She was part of the team of lawyers that sued Donald Trump for allegedly violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Ms. Teachout sits on the board of directors of the Open Markets Institute and teaches law at Fordham University. And she joins me to discuss her new book called Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. The book has a foreword by Senator Sanders. Welcome to the program, Zephyr.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's start with the idea that these companies have an outsized impact on our economy. There's a handful of them. And in fact, in one page of your book, you actually list them. They fit on less than a page. And I'm wondering if you can just give us a sampling of what these companies are. I mentioned Amazon and why they are such a problem and their size is such a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have an intuitive feeling of something being deeply, deeply, many things being deeply, deeply wrong in our economy and in our democracy. And the truth is the problems with our economy and our democracy are deeply connected. One of the key problems is that we have allowed, really over the last 40 years, just this collapse of a handful of companies who gobbled up all these small and medium-sized companies, merged with other giants, and gradually grown so large and so powerful and come to be at bottlenecks, at choke points in our economy, that they are effectively a kind of private government. You know, they call themselves private sector, but when you look at the amount of control and power they exercise over us as workers, small business owners, and citizens, it looks a lot more like what we think of as governmental than private companies competing in an open market. This is true in tech, and there's been a lot of attention on tech recently with the hearings in Congress, which are a potentially very exciting moment where people are saying, hey, wait a second, this is grotesque what's happening with the concentration of power there, but it's certainly also true in ag. It's true in office supplies. It's true in airlines. It's true in beer. You can buy, you know, you may think you have all these choices, but Budweiser and Beck's and hundreds of other brands are all owned in the back end by the same handful of companies. So we basically allowed for this collapse into these little tyrants that are sucking value and money out of the people who are creating value and money. So when you see this disconnect between extreme wealth and people just barely making do, one of the big machines that's allowed that to happen is the monopoly machine of these private governments.
You use the example of Mark Zuckerberg in your book, who, you know, he's just an individual, he's just a human being, but his whims and desires have massive impacts. And unfortunately, our politicians, especially those at the highest levels, take people like him and his ideas so seriously that his word effectively becomes policy. Can you expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I think Facebook in some ways is the easiest to show the ways in which something that is totally private and all about the profit motive has come to govern us, and we've kind of accepted that. Like, when you think of who is making privacy policy right now, when Mark Zuckerberg speaks, it's basically as if we had appointed a privacy czar and the decisions have that level of power, as if it were a federal agency in terms of the number of people who are impacted. But of course, Zuckerberg wasn't either himself elected or appointed by anybody who was elected or has any accountability mechanisms. And it's not just privacy. He's effectively, along with Google, becoming these really dangerous regulators of news and the news industry. Google and Facebook together really dominate the digital ad market. They've sucked away a lot of money from local newspapers, but they also control what's showing up in your feed, what shows up in your search results. And between the two of them have enormous control over the information that people get. Newspapers have been complaining, and last year Zuckerberg and Facebook set up a little team to say, no, we want to help newspapers and we're going to work with newspapers to make sure we promote their content. But that's also really dangerous. You don't want Zuckerberg teaming up as a kind of benign lord saying, no, I think we're going to let this newspaper do well and this one is going to be pushed down below. This is grotesque power over our public space. And even people who are mad at him, I think, tend to accept the naturalness of Facebook instead of what I think we should be doing is spending a lot more time pushing our elected officials to say, no, enough with private government. Not only do these companies need heavy regulation, they also should be broken up. Facebook has no business owning Instagram. We can have social media that isn't driven by a targeted ads business model. We should actually go at the root of their really toxic power.
In your chapter, The Chickenization of America, of the American middle class, you point out Tyson Foods as a really important company to examine. And this is a company that in recent months has been under scrutiny because of the horrendous COVID outbreaks in meat processing plants among workers and President Trump's intervention of these workers to classify these workers as essential workers, even though he didn't use that same power to, for example, produce personal protective equipment, which we needed much more than we needed chicken. How does the monopoly that Tyson controls affect American economy and also what we eat and our jobs, our, you know, workers' rights?
Yeah, I mean, I start the book with food for a bunch of reasons. One is nobody can deny the essential nature of food. And the control and concentration in our food industry is not only leading to bad food, but it's leading to this extraordinary set of cruel systems that really not just diminish the wages, but are really deeply humiliating to chicken farmers and workers who work within these systems. It's basically as if you have Tyson, these big distributors, sitting like jailers at the center of a system, and they're able to look out at each of the individuals and spy on them and collect information from them and experiment on them and extract as much, not just wealth, but information from people as possible, and then themselves take all the value there. And I think what is so, there's a few things that are really important about this. One is that if this is happening in food, this is a model for what's happening everywhere in society. Second, it's that one of the things that I really focused on is the ways in which this humiliation leads to depression and despair and a kind of debilitating anger. And I think often when we talk about economics, we have ceded the language of who has the right to talk about economics and what's the right terms to these really dry terms. But the impacts of these power imbalances lead to an incredible amount of psychic pain, and I think we have to talk about that. And finally, I think it's really important to show how chicken farmers who are subject to this arbitrary, experimenting, extractive power, their relationship to Tyson is so similar to Uber drivers' relationship to Uber, who also are subject to this tyrannical, experimental, extractive regime. And that relationship is also the same as Amazon sellers' relationship to Amazon, who takes as much as 30% of every sale and treats its own warehouse workers badly. So we're seeing in what we may think of as very different communities, really a really, really similar tyrannical business model. And I want to encourage us to forge unlikely alliances, to say, like, we've got to work together organizing franchisees whose relationship to the franchisor of McDonald's is also very similar. Franchisees working with chicken farmers, working with Uber drivers, working with Amazon warehouse workers, and all together taking on the shared enemy of these monopolistic tyrants.
In that same chapter around food, you raise another trend which has become markedly more prominent just during the pandemic, and which is how food production relates to food delivery services. And this is basically, I suppose, the future of how people eat, using, you know, apps that rely on technology that then coordinate with companies like Uber and the Postmates and Grubhub companies, all of which extract pretty significant commissions from usually small restaurants that, you know, and these restaurants feel like they have to join these programs in order to compete with the bigger chains. This also just seems to be a race to the bottom based on the monopoly pressures from top.
I mean, it was bad before. I finished the book before the pandemic.
I figured, yeah.
I want to rewrite it because there's so many ways in which we've seen how crazy and cruel this fragile system is. When you look at medical systems or the fragility in our hospital systems, but before the pandemic, it was already a problem. Now, think of restaurants. Think of your favorite restaurants and how important they are in a community, and how central they are in building connections in a community. Restaurants who rely on delivery, which is increasingly almost all restaurants, as a key part of being able to survive on small margins, basically have to be on these big delivery platforms, or it's a death sentence. If you have an amazing restaurant, but it isn't showing up on a seamless Grubhub, then most people aren't going to be able to find it. And so these platforms then have an incredible amount of control and can extract value from those restaurants, charging huge fees to be on the services. But that's just the first step. The next step, which you can see flows very naturally from what Amazon and Tyson and Uber have done, is for the delivery apps or platforms to peer in and gather a lot of data from those restaurants to basically force them to treat their workers worse to extract the maximum value. And one of the things I care a lot about is I think there's a tendency on left and right, people who think this is terrible or people who think this is wonderful, to look at technology as somehow determinative. Like, well, this is the gig economy. And if right. you celebrate it, you think this is a wonderful feature of technology. And if what most of us see is the ways in which it's really hurting people, we say that technology caused this. And that's actually allowed lawmakers to avoid responsibility for not acting to totally stop this kind of abusive theft. It's not technology, it's a business model. We have tools to deal with this kind of thing. We're just choosing not to use it. And technology, I think, stands in the way, and people say, oh, it's tech, and they feel like there's nothing they can do.
You also talk about journalism in your book, which of course is obviously deeply personal for me. And we mentioned Jeff Bezos earlier, who owns the Washington Post. How has the monopoly power of these massive companies killed journalism, or, you know, at least maimed it?
Well, this is an area where, again, I think we've got it wrong culturally. We think, oh, the internet killed local newspapers because the internet came along and then newspapers could no longer survive. That is a simple story and it's a wrong story. It is true that in the early days of widespread internet usage, news sources lost some of their sources of revenue, but they still could survive on targeted ads. I mean, there's a handful of newspapers like the New York Times that can survive on subscriptions, basically. But most newspapers relied on local ads or ads to survive. That was the business model. Google and Facebook came along and started doing something extraordinary. They started advertising next to the stories written by journalists who had done all the work. So basically, I use the example of the Daily News in New York, which was already struggling when I wrote the book, and they've just closed their newsroom. This is a really important working class newspaper in New York, and whether or not you agree with everything they say, it's like an incredible source of basic news. What's happening in a construction with the construction industry? So journalists do the hard work of telling the story of a horrific construction accident. That story gets shared on Facebook, and then Facebook is making the money that the Daily News used to make. Mm. And this is just sucking huge essential revenues, especially from local journalism and working class journalism, and the cost is amazing. And again, there's a technological determinism about it. We say, well, the internet did it, instead of, no, we actually should not allow Facebook and Google to play that kind of bridge troll choke point role. We can demand that they change their business model. We have agency to have a society where there's news and people have dignity, and people who create things earn good wages for their creations, as opposed to a society where anytime there's a margin, you hear this great sucking sound and it's going to one of a handful of monopolists.
So the theme, of course, is that these companies do what they can because they can get away with it and present it as inevitable, and our elected officials roll over and allow them to set the agenda. The solution is to reset the agenda, right? To start to apply laws that already exist. We have antitrust laws in this nation that have been used, but in the distant past. So is it a matter of just having the political will to apply these laws, or do we need new regulations for the digital age that we're living in now that really is, you know, in some ways unprecedented?
Yeah. I mean, I think all of the above. I think there's a few things that are very unique to the digital age. Like, there's certain, we should ban facial recognition technology. There's certain kinds of data that shouldn't be allowed to be extracted, period. There's certain business models that shouldn't be allowed to exist for basically what are public utilities. We shouldn't allow Facebook and Google to use the targeted ad business model. We have a traditional way of providing essential communications infrastructure that does not require maximizing addiction and data and surveillance and collecting data. So those are particular changes that I think we need because of tech. But there is also this, like, I think of it as like a huge box of rusty, powerful tools that are just sitting there and just need some cleaning off to be used. I think when it comes to anti-monopoly, people now, not traditionally, now get really intimidated and they feel, well, I don't know all the tools and I don't know exactly what constitutes market share. And so I don't know. And they feel stuck and focus on other things. If I have one purpose here, it is to say, please don't be intimidated, because a root issue of so much that you care about is monopoly power. If we're just going to allow these companies to amass power, we're always going to end up begging them for scraps as opposed to actually being able to have a fair and open and free society. And I really want to shake the shoulders of progressives to say, okay, you say you care about corporate concentration, you say you care about corporate power, but tell me, when is the last time you marched in the streets? When is the last time that you stood up and made a lot of noise with your local elected officials saying, why haven't you done anything about Facebook? There's really exciting things happening now. The new regulations on Uber and Lyft, for instance, are so critical. A lot of the excitement and energy is in California. There's amazing anti-Amazon work going on with a new coalition of labor and other groups coming together to say, this is an illegitimate company. And the key thing we're seeing in both of these areas, which is so essential, and I wanna challenge everybody, but progressives, to do more of this, is people are moving past a corporate accountability framework where you say, please be nicer, Jeff Bezos, and moving to a corporate illegitimacy framework, which is to say, these companies can't exist in this form. They either can become public utilities, or they can be broken up, or ideally, both.
A huge part of the problem is that the money that they sit on translates into political power simply because of our broken political system that allows corporations, through decisions like Citizens United, to wield enormous power to shape our discourse to begin with, right? I mean, this is a huge part of the problem, that people feel helpless because they're told that they have little power because these companies wield a lot of power. But, you know, maybe there's, once we pull back the curtain, there's not as much power as we think there is. So what are some of the ways in which these companies subvert our political process, subvert democracy itself, which ought not, should not to be a partisan issue?
No, this absolutely should not be. I mean, one of the side effects of Citizens United, which I have spent a lot of time writing about, was cited in the dissent of Citizens United. So I was writing about Citizens United before it came, before it was decided. This real threat to our already fragile democracy. One of the side effects has been growing employer ability to have control over, spy on, retaliate against workers for their political activity. Because what Citizens United did is it said, oh, corporations, as so long as they aren't coordinating with a candidate, have unlimited political speech rights. So now you take Citizens United on the one hand and surveillance capacity on the other, and you join them, and suddenly at work, you have employers who are in some cases already using this power, and in other cases just sort of building capacity to punish, to spy on people's social media accounts and listen into conversations at work. And the impact is not just when the companies in fact act and in fact tell an employee, you're out of here for political reasons. It's that the fear of them acting has a profound impact. It really makes it harder to unionize. It makes it harder to organize. And the number of people who are afraid of political retaliation in work is really going up, and who can blame them? That hammer is sitting there. And of course, that threat of retaliation is so much more dangerous when you have a concentrated economy. If you've got one of only a few companies that you can work for in whatever field you're in, getting fired by one company when, by the way, they're kind of in the same club as the other company is really, really dangerous. So it has this major impact on our politics. I mean, this connects to your last question, which is to say, this is tough. I mean, this is, I'm not talking about small challenges here. It's not about just simply flipping a switch and then we'll enforce antitrust laws again. I do think it will require movement work. It will require more than understanding all the intricacies of what predatory pricing is, or how we can enforce against tying contracts. I just use that as a technical term from antitrust law. More important is the grassroots work, because people are scared and I don't blame them. They feel alone and fragile and I don't blame them. But it means that we have to do as much work as possible to create moments of solidarity and opportunities to say, This is a democracy moment for us. Concentrated corporate power is a threat to people governing themselves. We're told we're free, but we're not stupid. We can see the ways in which we're not free.
Right. And the companies that you single out in your book that I mentioned that, earlier in our conversation, fit on less than a page, impact all of us. You know, there probably isn't a single person in America that isn't impacted by at least one, if not 5 or 10 of these companies: Amazon, Alphabet, Google, Monsanto, Bayer, Spectrum, Pfizer, Uber, Visa, Unilever, Verizon, Exxon, Bank of America, Citibank, Common Spirit Health, Disney, CVS, Nestle, United Healthcare, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Comcast, Boeing, and Walmart. You know, I can probably say that at least half of those I interact with, but the other half I probably interact with, but just don't know I interact with, because they're fronts for smaller companies or whatever.
And I do feel, just to be clear, that isn't the list of all companies that need to be broken up, but it's a example list. One of the things that it's a place to start. Companies on that list, which is, I think, a really important area, just to look at consolidation in hospitals and hospital networks, that you see people are really focused, understandably, on their insurance company. And I am a major supporter of Medicare for All. I think it's absolutely morally necessary. Most of people's interactions with the healthcare system start with the insurance company. But the truth is, a lot of the extraordinary gross costs come from consolidation among hospitals. And there's a lot of good research that shows that when you consolidate hospitals, first of all, you lose the kind of redundancy that you need in a crisis like this. It's been called the Great American Bedshed, when we lost so many hospital beds because people said, how few do we need, not how many do we need? But also, they can start to charge enormous amounts, because if you have a consolidated, if you have one hospital in a region instead of three or four, that's the hospital. They set the price.
That's the local monopoly, yeah.
And it's true whether or not, and this is important, it's true whether or not they are technically for-profit or not-for-profit, because not-for-profit hospitals are money-making machines, too. It's not that title alone doesn't tell you whether or not the people at the top are making a gross amount of money off of people suffering. And consolidation in the healthcare sector, I think, is something we have to deal with. Medicare for All, yes. And at the same time, we don't want a public insurer to be negotiating with one or two Goliaths who basically can set the terms, driving up prices.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Zephyr. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Zephyr Teachout, attorney, political activist, antitrust and corruption expert. She ran for New York Attorney General in 2018. She sits on the board of directors of the Open Markets Institute and teaches law at Fordham University. We've been discussing her new book, Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and big money. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
To KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.